So I think it's helpful to take this radical thing that we're doing here and put it into the context of the life that we're living, which includes what's going on all around us. So one of the things that I've talked about lately is this dispassion aspect to our practice, how critically important it is, how it enables us to get underneath the level of forms that keep us floating in a world of planning, thinking, strategizing. We can never quite get down to the root of what this actually is, the substance of our life. But we're engaging in this practice in the setting of a world on fire, a world on fire. You can't deny it. It's not just right around us. I mean, just driving down the street and observing people struggling, and perhaps in our individual jobs. You know, I happen to be an ER doctor. I see that in my everyday job. But what's going on in the world with belief systems, hatreds, murdering, mayhem, destruction, incredible hatreds that go back centuries. This is the world that we live in. Now, what is fueling all of this? What is feeding this intense difficulty, struggle, suffering, pain? You know, as the Buddha said, life is suffering, first noble truth. What is fueling it? What's behind it? What's underneath it? This world of particularities, this world of form, it's very easy to get strongly attached to our ideas about how it ought to be, what we want to have as an outcome, what's threatening that outcome, how severely we must deal with the threat to that outcome that we desire, that we're attached to, that we have to have. It translates in so many ways. It translates into political parties, religious affiliations, nationalistic affiliations, racial affiliations, and then the fear that comes about from that and the hatred that comes about from that, all of which are involved with trying to take a particular form the world is and change it into a form we want more and avoid forms we want less, or that we can't possibly contemplate happening. Now, it'd be easy in this viewpoint, which is, I think, quite sane, quite clear-minded, perhaps even very scientific, to make the mistake of not caring, seeing the danger of this attachment process, this identification process, this naming and affiliating, and then all the things that come of that, to see that process, how damaging, how destructive it is, and to just say, I don't want anything to do with it. I want to retreat into a quiet, solid place. There's a danger there. Perhaps I'll read something to you, and this stimulated my thinking about it. I actually got an email from a high school student. Her name is Emma, and she's doing some kind of a paper on Buddhism. I think they, in her high school, are doing a paper on various religious topics or whatever. So she decided to get in touch with an American Buddhist in capital letters. I want to talk to an American Buddhist. I want to interview an American Buddhist. See what they think about something. So I said to her, write down some questions that you would want me to answer. I'm happy to help you with this. Somehow she got me through the website. Must have done a Google search. So I'll read to you what she wrote me. And it's very thoughtful and it's very touching. And it addresses some of what I just said. So Emma wrote this. She laid out four questions. So the first question was, does the idea detachment, and evidently she had done some research into Buddhism, and this word particularly came to her mind and also perhaps troubled her. Does the idea detachment imply a lack of concern for humanity? That is to say, is detachment more of an inward reflection of oneself than it is an outward view of the world? Question number two. Does detachment discourage possession, i.e. things belonging to, and this is in quotes, me, or are, quotes, mine? Third one here was, does detachment discourage all emotional attachment, or can some things merit one's emotional investment? And the fourth question she wrote me was, what are some of the challenges one faces as an American Buddhist in a country where consumerism and materialism is so prominent? Also, if you have anything else that might be useful for my research, please feel free to let me know. Thanks so much, Emma. What incredible questions. Probably a 17-year-old girl. I think she's a senior. So at the risk of steering her completely wrong, wrote her back, and this is what I wrote her. I actually wrote this just before I came here. So I wrote, Emma. Oh, that was my message that I couldn't actually be physically interviewed by her, and we'd better do this by email. So here it is. Here's the answer. Hi, Emma. Detachment may not be the best word to describe a certain aspect of training in Buddhist meditation. A better word, I think, is non-attachment. Attachment would be getting emotionally stuck, either by clinging to something inevitably transient or rejecting something inevitably present. Non-attachment enables one to better go with the flow of events, be flexible and highly responsive. This is a key aspect of training in Buddhist meditation. I specifically teach my students techniques along these lines. The word I prefer to use is dispassion, another way of saying not getting hung up on things and situations. The problem with the word detachment is that it implies a lack of feeling or caring. On the contrary, compassion is highly valued in Buddhism and is the very measure of one's progress and level of attainment. Compassion means resonating with the feelings of others and wanting to make others feel happier and safer. The more we get disentangled from negative emotions and habitual, unthinking reactions, the more we are able to do this. When a Buddhist teacher assesses the level of understanding of a student, she observes the student's interactions and whether they project a sense of empathy and wholeheartedness. This is the opposite of detachment. And I answered a couple of the other questions about possessions. So I said here, possessions are fine, but attachment to possessions, as in selfishness and greediness, leads to suffering. Emotional involvement is fine, but certain emotions such as anger, jealousy, envy, etc. are destructive. All of this is sensible and not unique to Buddhism. The unique thing about Buddhism is the emphasis on mindfulness and letting go of all beliefs, and by beliefs I put in parentheses, fixed, unquestioned ideas about reality. In this way we learn directly and not through dogma, habit, tradition, and blind faith. I feel that being a Buddhist is nothing special, but simply normal, scientific, and sensible. It should be, quote, invisible, as in fully integrated with one's life and not added on or carried around as an affectation. In this way, it's no problem being a Buddhist in any environment. Furthermore, I don't think of myself as a Buddhist, but rather as a human being, just like everybody else. I'm a human being, that avoids beliefs, tries to stay alert and flexible, and practices kindness as much as possible. Hope that helps. So, I want to go a little more in depth into this. How do we get to this non-detached, caring, compassionate dispassion? How do we get there? How do we avoid the trap of beliefs, affiliations, blind faith, identification with a dogma, a set of people, a system? How do we do that? I really like to, when I'm not sure how to approach something in this realm, revert to science. I like to revert to science. I feel it's the opposite of all these things that we want to avoid, these blind faiths, this attachment process. Science is so different. I was taking a walk with my 11-year-old granddaughter on Thanksgiving Day. We took a walk down the street. And we started talking about science versus religion. And we talked about how science is in some ways the very opposite of religion, as I will define it. Religion being a belief system that tells you what to believe, that wants you to hold to that belief and wants you not to question it. Or if you do question it, for you to come around to the inevitable admission and recognition that the belief was right and that your questioning was wrong. And science makes a model of reality in order to try to manipulate it, understand it better, predict it better, but at its very root is trying to disprove the model. It holds the model so lightly that it actually tries to disprove it. It does everything possible, every test, statistics, double-blind studies, you name it, in order to try to disprove this model. And it's only through the failure of repeated attempts to disprove the model that you begin to have some faith in the model, but always understanding that somewhere down the line, your model's going to be wrong. And that, to me, is the essence of the scientific approach. It's so elegant. It's so honest. It's really, in a way, very, very humble. It's saying, I don't really know. It's entering this not knowing, trying to make sense of it, but never doing it in a way that's dogmatic. The Dalai Lama, actually, the leader of the Tibetan tradition, is such a remarkable human being. He wrote a book a few years ago. It was called The Universe and an Atom. And I've been listening to some CDs that were given to me for my birthday years ago by my wife. And I've recently been driving back and forth to Boston a lot, visiting my mother in the hospital, and listening to these CDs. And just the elegance with which he describes science and how it mirrors what he views as true Buddhism. And he has said, if science contradicts some view that Buddhism has of reality, Buddhism must change. How refreshing. How refreshing. How could a leader of religion with this attitude, who has gotten training in science, he sought out scientists all over the world to come and tutor him so he could learn about everything possible. His curiosity is so immense. How could a leader of a tradition like this want followers that blindly followed belief systems, dogma, identified with this, and then violently defended their opinions and beliefs? It's not possible. So, how can we use science to help us? He mentions quantum physics. He says it's very difficult. It's very hard to get your mind around. I love it. To me, it's like working with a column. Quantum physics, one of its wonderful realizations, discoveries, is that the quantum world, the world of the very tiny, in other words, when you go to the very smallest, think about your zazen now, when you penetrate down to the rock bottom, when you get into the very moment-by-moment reality of your internal state, you are entering a quantum state. You are entering a state where things are not necessarily one thing or the other. Matter of fact, they can be two things at the same time. They can be both. Form can be emptiness, and emptiness can be form. How strange. What a strange world. Now, in quantum physics, there was a very famous experiment. It was called the double slit experiment. And it aimed to discover, in the most paradoxical way, the dual nature of light. Now, light or photons are tiny particles that have a strange property. And it's not unique to photons. It's true of other subatomic particles and atoms. And atoms, which are the building blocks of everything in this room. Your body, your chemical processes in your brain, which leads to your thinking and everything else. So when you fire off photons at a screen that blocks the photons except for two narrow vertical slits, and you look at a screen behind, what you see is what's called an interference pattern, which proves that what was hitting these slits actually had a wave quality. Now, what do we mean by wave quality? We mean that the photon was in no particular place, it was in every place at the same time. Now, this is true even if you fire off one photon. One photon. They have lasers that can fire off a single photon at two slits in a barrier to light. And when you look behind those slits at a screen, what you see is not a single photon, you see a wave pattern. A wave pattern is actually showing you where the photon can be all at the same time, with the darkest bars the place it's most likely to be, and the lightest bars the place it's least likely to be. And this is a single photon. Now, here's how the experiment blows your mind. If you put a little sensor on only one of the two slits, and the sensor in no way interacts with the photon in any way that we can determine, if you watch that slit to see if the photon went through that slit or didn't go through that slit, when you look at the screen behind, you don't see a wave pattern anymore. You see a single dot where the photon hit. Somehow the photon knows you're watching it. And what's called the, I will define it as, the cloud of probability, this interference pattern, which is showing where that photon could be, where it's most likely and least likely to be, collapses into one single point. Now, this will happen if the photon goes through the slit you're watching, or if it doesn't go through the slit you're watching. So if you fire off the photon and your little sensor doesn't go off, there's been no interaction, when you look at the screen behind, there's still a single dot. Somehow the photon knew you're watching it. What a strange property of reality. What a strange property. This is profound. This is exactly what we're doing here. How? If you think about your life, if you think about what we engage ourselves with every day, what seems most interesting to us, what seems most compelling, most anxiety-provoking, is the cloud of probability. It's what might happen next. And all our efforts to make something more likely than something else, and yes, we can do that. We can influence probability by the choices we make, the stocks we buy, the food we eat, whether or not we decide to smoke cigarettes, etc., etc., etc. Whether I put on my seatbelt, whether I wear a helmet when I ride my bike, okay? But think of the investment in this cloud of probability. the worry about what might happen next, the worry about my finance, the worry about my kids, the desire to make more money, the desire to have a bigger flat screen TV, all these things, this is all the cloud of probability. It's so interesting, it's so attractive, it's so compelling, but it's so attachment creating, it's so anxiety provoking. It's where all this mischief happens too. What can we balance it with? What can we balance it with? Now in our everyday life, we're very, very involved in this cloud of probability. But when we come into the Zendo and we sit down in Zazen, we completely set aside the cloud of probability and we allow it to collapse. We allow that wave pattern to collapse into a spot. And what do I mean by this? One way I've described it is this. The world that you know, not the world that you are concerned about happening or not happening and trying to influence, but the world that you know is the world that has happened. The world that you know is the world that has happened. And Zazen is all about the world that you know. The world that you know. We do something very radical here. We leave aside, we put down, we stop our involvement as best as possible with the cloud of probability, and we enter the world that we know, the actual sensations in our body-mind, including thoughts, which are sensations, including emotions, which are sensations. But this entire flow, this thing described in Buddhism as impermanent, and of one single fabric, a fabric of space-time, continually changing. Here we are back in science again. Impermanent. Second law of thermodynamics. Single fabric of space-time. Everything started from a singularity and spread out equally all throughout the universe. Nothing is isolated from anything else in that sense. We start there. Our body, our posture, the sensation of it, the focal point, and all the panoply of sensory experiences, thoughts, emotions, and feelings that are continually ever-changing and passing through our mind, and we notice something. We notice that by the moment we perceive anything, the moment we're conscious of anything, the moment anything passes into our awareness, it's just like that electron that knows it's being watched, the cloud of probability collapses. What we experience moment by moment is done, inevitable, completed. All the causes and conditions, all the karmic properties, potentialities, have led to this specific configuration of what we might call form, sound, color, taste, touch, thought, emotions, etc., etc., in this moment, this moment, this moment, this moment. When we really get that, when we get that the cloud of probability has collapsed, there's no bargaining with it. It's done and dusted. I'm sitting here and this is my moment. I can finally what? Be dispassionate about it. Because I don't need to contend with it. I don't need to fight it. I don't need to change it. Because all of that is irrelevant. What I'm in now is the world of actuality. I'm not involving myself with the cloud of probability. I'll do that when I get up and leave. I have to. But I'm doing something radical here. I'm entering the actual world, not the probable world that lives mostly in my thoughts and fears. I'm dealing here with the actual world. I'm empowering myself. I'm entering this actual physical world and seeing that it's done. Therefore, I don't need to fight it. I don't need to hold on to it. I don't need to understand it. I don't need to figure it out. I don't need to name it. I can just be with it. Let it be there. So whereas in the cloud of probability, the feeling tone is anxiety, desire, and strategy, here the feeling tone in this world of the collapsed cloud of probability, in the plunging into the central experience of our Zazen, the feeling tone here is embracing, embracing, we allow, we get it, we profoundly understand it's done. I can now just be with it, I can see it, I can notice it exactly as it is. I can enter it now, I can see something shining from it. I couldn't see this thing shining from it before because I was too involved with what might happen, what I have to do, how I can change it, how shitty this thing is, how much I want it not to leave me, all these things. But here in my zazen, with this beautiful balanced posture, my mind's eye in the pit of my stomach, plunged into this present moment, seeing that in each moment the cloud of probability collapsed. The life that I know, the world that I know, is the world that has already happened. I can let it go and embrace it and let it be as it is and see what's shining. It's fact. It's presence. What an amazing, mysterious, mind-blowing thing that there is anything at all. And each and every thing that enters my awareness as this cloud of probability has collapsed in my attentive sitting, is emanating that, showing me that. How mind-blowing. This is the beginning, this is the entry door into a different kind of understanding, a freedom, a centeredness, a dispassion that is very connected, that feels intensely, that responds, that's very free, that isn't withdrawn, that isn't self-centered. It sees a single connected fabric. It understands that fabric had to be as it is right now. But it's always, always, always emanating this one thing, what you might call true nature, Buddha nature, being. As God said on Mount Sinai, I am that I am. This is what we begin to enter. This is what my teacher used to refer to when he ironically would say, most people are looking south trying to find the North Star. So here we learn how to turn north. This is the beginning of turning north to find the North Star. So Emma helped me kind of clarify that a little bit in my own mind, and I thought I would share it with all of you. And there's actually a little time if there's any comments or questions. As I promised the new folks here tonight, please feel free to ask a question or say whatever you want.
Just a thought that flashed in my mind when you were talking about that question, does a tree that falls in the forest make the sound?
Right. Here's the thing about this. When you begin to enter your actual experience, when the cloud of probability collapses into this actual moment, and you at the same time see its inevitability and its doneness, therefore you begin to put down the reflex reactions to the sensory fabric here, and you begin therefore to liberate yourself to see what's shining from it, okay, which is its presence. As you enter that and you look into its fact, not its content, but its fact. In other words, what I've said before, that it is rather than what it is. You begin to get something about that, that the fact of the world is absolutely intimate. How could something be if not in your center? How could a tree make a sound if not in your center? So we would go even further than that. We would say, if a tree falls in the woods and you're not there, does it make a sound? So this is the very concrete, simple, direct experience of your zazen. That something is, what it shines, this moon of truth emanating from everything, is absolutely intimate. It cannot be outside your center. Matter of fact, it is proof of your center, your center. Now, you go into that even. You go deeply into that center and you realize that center is not an individual. It doesn't have characteristics. It's not an entity. It's not walled off. It has no borders. It has no end point. It has no beginning point. It's really like space. It permeates. It enters everything. It's what enables you and I to understand each other, to connect. How could we connect if we were utterly separate entities? There has to be something that is common to us, a spacious commonality. So we begin to get this sense as we go deep into the space. Now, going deep into the space is a term for it in Zen practice and in Buddhism. It's called samadhi, samadhi. So this samadhi space is when you really go deeply first into the presence of the object. So how I define mindfulness in the context of Zazen is staying very clear with the actuality of this collapsed cloud of probability as you observe its presence. That to me is the definition of mindfulness. And what I call inquiry is with deep questioning, what is the substance of what I'm calling presence? What seems to be out there seems to be a property inhering to the object. I begin to understand it doesn't inhere to the object. This presence permeates. There's no separation between the object and me in this presence. This is inquiry. It brings you into the space. Now, as you enter this deep questioning, this deep space, it's a very strange thing that sitters all experience. They experience a kind of a darkness. It's a very alive darkness. But it has no particular color, sound, smell, taste, touch. That's there, but you're pointing north now. So it starts to recede a bit, and you start to enter something different, something very, very intimate. It's very intimate, but has no qualities. It's very intimate, but has no name. It's very intimate, but is neither male nor female. It's not even human or animal. It's not inside or outside. Now, Basui described it as a blue sky with no clouds. Hakuin called it the bottom of a black lacquer bucket. He also described it as the grand round mirror as black as pitch. This is that state of samadhi. We don't even stop there. The great masters of old have always said you have to smash through the bottom of the black lacquer bucket. You have to jump off the top of the 100-foot pole and manifest your body in the 10 directions. And that is what we call, in this practice, enlightenment or kensho. So I've given you this whirlwind overview, not so much to create a map, but to show you how mysterious and profound this practice is. It's so powerful and profound. As you go more deeply into it, you can only feel gratitude that you somehow luckily and stupidly stumbled upon it. You could have just made a right turn to go get a hamburger, but you didn't. It's kind of like on that level, and like I keep being amazed that somehow I didn't turn and get the hamburger. So anyway, I think our time is up, and we'll end here tonight, and we'll have the four vows.